So this is the Lessard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council meeting, March 14th. We have members, Jane and Sue are going to call in. We're going to actually call them, but we've got to approve the agenda in a minute, so we don't have to do a roll call vote on that first. So first on the agenda, a couple of changes I want to recommend and then ask for a motion. The first is that we want an update, obviously, on where the bill is at, and Rick has to leave early, so I want to move that up to right after Bill's report. The second thing is, I know there's some concern on the search. I want to have a short discussion about that right after the minutes, if that's all right.
And the search, you say, is for the
executive director.
Okay.
So can I get a motion for approval of the agenda with those two changes?
So moved.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carried. You have the minutes in front of you. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the minutes.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. And we'll pause momentarily.
Sue, will you stand here? Can you hold?
Can you hear us now?
Yes.
We can really hear you.
I don't know if there's anything I can do about that.
We'll turn you down. Any conflict of interest to report today on the agenda? Jim?
So I just have one question, and maybe this is the wrong time to bring it up, but in the future, if we have projects that deal with the band or any of the bands, will legislators have conflicts of interest in those discussions?
Based on what?
Donation, party donations, or things of that nature.
They have to disclose, I guess,
okay,
if they feel there is one.
Would a campaign finance contribution be considered a conflict if they are receiving funds from the Outdoor Heritage Fund?
I have never in the legislature had or heard of that occurring. If staff knows of an instance, bring it up. But that's not something that I've ever heard brought up.
As a conflict. Janelle, you don't think there's a...
I would be happy to make the inquiry. I mean, there's, can we get back to you in writing as to whether this has ever happened?
I think the same would be true from any organization or person affiliated with an organization, if that were the case. You know, if the head of the Nature Conservancy of Minnesota had given Tom a donation, does he have to declare a conflict with that? I don't think so.
Mr. Chair, that was my only point. I would, if staff was going to inquire, I would ask that it be an inquiry in a broad-based way. Does any contribution, pose a conflict? I don't know why it would matter from a tribe or a member. And I'm not even sure if tribes can actually give money to campaigns, so I don't even know all that. So, sorry, I think it's a relevant question, but I would put it in a more broad-based one.
Okay. Well, Bill, if you'll look at that, see if you can find anything. Any other questions? I want to talk a little bit about the search and just clarify the process. I have a handout, and I'd just like to go through this in terms of what we're looking at in the search process. And I think, Sue, both you and Jane have received this by email this morning. Is that correct? Sue and Jane?
Technology.
Are you with us? Hello? Can you fix it?
Yeah, that's right.
So anyhow, I want to just go through what the process was in 2009, what the statute and operating procedures say, and what the process that I've laid out in 2013 will be in conjunction with LCC, which has a significant role in this process. In 2009, LCC coordinated the process. The initial LCC screenings was done with the advice of a panel of nonpartisan joint services employees. They screened candidates for the qualities required for the nonpartisan joint services LCC. LCC next convened a panel of members to assist. It's different than a committee.
Are you there?
Well, we're getting disconnected. It's a little more complicated. We're trying to call out. Can you just hold and I'll try to get Sue on the line?
I can call in.
Right, you can't do that because Sue can't call in.
Sue, for those of you that don't know, had some surgery this week, and she expended all of her cell phone minutes dealing with her medical problem while she was on vacation, so she can't call in for the meeting.
Okay,
today.
We're trying to get this out. We got disconnected somehow. Hold on. Okay, you guys there?
I am.
All right, we'll try this again. So the LCC convened a panel of members to assist in the search process. The panel forwarded names to the Personnel Committee, which was a committee of the board, but not the full council. The Personnel Committee interviewed one candidate, Bill, in a public meeting and recommended him to the full council then. After the council's action, Greg Kubinger met with LCC's chair, and staff, and there was an intentional review and agreement acceptance of the appointment of Bill as the director. So in terms of statute, just to remind everyone, in case you've forgotten, which I had, the statute regarding the Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Councils is provided in 97A, .56, subdivision 2H. Upon coordination with the LCC, the council may appoint nonpartisan staff and contract with consultants as necessary to carry out the functions of the council. The council's administrative budget is actually appropriated to the LCC, and therefore they have the authority and responsibility to oversee it and the Lasard Sam's staff. This arrangement indicates the legislature intends a strong role for the LCC in the Lasard Sam's business matters. Then if you refer to our operating procedures on page 7, the council selects and recommends the individual who will serve as the council's executive director to the Legislative Coordinating Commission. This obviously acknowledges a significant role for the LCC in the hiring process. The LCC.
it's a recommendation by the council to the LCC. Pick the person. This is who we want. Here's our recommendation to you.
So let me just go to the process that I've worked out with the LCC for that. And I don't know where B went in this. The LCC, working with the chair, develops a process plan for the hiring of a new director that allows the council to participate but avoids any violation of the open meeting law. Any gathering, any committee has to be subject to the open meeting law. The LCC is going to convene an advisory panel from the council to assist it in the search process. The criteria that I've worked out with the LCC is that you can't have a quorum of any existing committee of the council. In terms of legislative members, we want to have one Democrat and one Republican. We want this to be bipartisan. We want one senator and one House member so that we have representation from both sides. Citizen members, we want one member from each of the appointing authorities so that you don't run into a circumstance where you've got three governor appointees and no House and Senate and someone calls foul. And that members should be those that are going to actually serve with the new executive director. I've done a lot of searches, and the question that always comes from a candidate is, who am I working with? And they want to work with people. They want to know who they're working with. It's really important in a search process that the folks that are on the front line are going to work with the candidate. But then the LCC is going to provide an updated job description for the whole to the whole council for their approval, and I think we have that today to pass out. They want everybody's suggestions on what that job description should look like before they go and publicize. The advisory panel will work with the LCC then to finalize the job description. The LCC is going to do all the administrative work of publicizing the opening, doing the initial sort of candidates, and the staff of LCC will do that, and then work with the council advisory panel to narrow the field of candidates to a manageable number that will be interviewed by LCC staff. There will be a smaller group of candidates then that the advisory panel will conduct the second round of interviews and present candidates to the full council for consideration. The full council, in an open meeting, will then interview the finalists and say yay or nay. We like this candidate, we want this one, or we don't like any of the slate here, go back to the drawing board. So the full council in the end makes the decision to recommend to the LCC who that final candidate will be. So this group as a whole will do that. So that's the process that I've worked out with the LCC that really gives us a way of narrowing the field, avoiding open meeting law issues until we get to that final interview phase where the entire council will have an opportunity to do the interview and make the recommendation then to LCC for the hire. So, any questions on the process? Scott?
I've got a couple questions, concerns. You know, when, who, and at what point, where in the process will the LCC be told what kind of a candidate the council's looking for?
That's in the job description.
Okay, so they wrote the job description.
And you're going to get a copy, the council's going to get a copy, and is asked for input on that. Do we like it or don't we like it? Do we want it changed in this way or that way? It is essentially, it looks like Bill's job description today. I know they tweaked it a little bit as in terms of a recommended job description, but they want our complete input. So if anyone's got input, that becomes what the kind of person is.
How much time will we have? I mean, is that job description's here today?
That job description is here today.
And how much time do we have to comment on that? Is that a week? Is that 30 minutes, or is it?
So our goal is to have someone hired by the end of July and on board by the beginning of September. So assuming someone will give a month's notice. If you back up from that, we're probably not looking at actually going out with a job description that's posted for at least another month. So there's a lot of time for job descriptions playing with. Greg, would you agree with that? Yeah, he's nodding. We're looking at a month in terms of time to have input. So it's not a short-term little deal. We're getting it. I mean, we are so fortunate to have, 6 months to work on this or 5 months to work on this versus Bill giving us 2 weeks' notice which could have happened this year especially. So other questions? Jim?
Well, a couple things, David. I don't understand why the council wasn't consulted before this process was developed. That's one question.
Okay. Because I felt as the chair I needed to put a stake in the sand and do it.
Well, that's not part of your job description. This is the most important decision we're going to probably make this year. I think as much time as we have, it would have been nice if the council was consulted before this process was developed. Just going through the process, I still don't understand why the LCC is driving the selection process. I understand they handle the business part of it, but why are they driving the selection part of it? Why isn't the council driving that?
Because it's their job to do it, and that's what the legislature has instructed them to do by statute.
It says it's our job to select the person.
They manage the budget and the staffing. The staffing actually reports to the LCC, not to the council.
I understand that, but I'm talking about the process of finding the person to take this job. It's the council's job to do the selection part of it.
And the council will do the picking of the person and recommend it to the LCC.
Okay, well, it looks like they're driving the process. And just going down to the, as far as your committee.
It's not a committee.
Okay, what should we call it?
It is a advisory panel.
Okay, the advisory panel. Why wouldn't the people that have been on the council for the longest period have more insight as to who and what a good executive director is than people who've been on for 1 year? And as far as working with them, this person could be here for 2 decades. The people that on your panel could be here for 2 years. So the argument that's the people they're going to be working with is pretty short term. I think you would want to use the experience of people who've been around for a while to be part of this selection process.
They will be part of the selection.
After it's said and done.
It's not said and done. The full council will interview and say yes or no to any candidate.
Right.
Candidates.
But if all the candidates brought before us are unacceptable,
then we get it back and go and say no. Find other candidates.
But I think it would be much more efficient if we brought the best candidates forward right from the get-go.
Well, the LCC did bring Bill forward as the best candidate the first time. Are you saying that you don't think they will?
I'm saying I think the council should be driving the process, not the LCC.
We cannot do this subject to the open meeting law. You can't do a hiring process that is in the open. It doesn't work.
With all due respect, David, we've got plenty of time. We can call meetings. We've got an open book. We can call as many meetings as we want. The open meeting law is, in my opinion, irrelevant.
Well, I will tell you there is a huge group of people who will never apply if their names are identified as applying for it because it will jeopardize their current job.
What are you talking about identifying their names?
It's an open meeting. You have to identify.
I'm talking about the process. I'm talking about the process and the qualifications that we're going to use to bring the person forward.
Danny?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I would say is really, really important here is we're an advisory board to the legislature, and we're talking about a really important thing that we have some input on, but there's a lot of current state law that dictates how a public employee gets hired, and we need to be really careful in following that law, and I think it'd be really important. If we have questions for Mr. Hubinger in how the LCC is supposed to deal with this, I think those would be appropriate, but we have to make it clear it's not this commission's job to hire the executive director solely. It is not. It would not. We would not be following state law. There's application processes. The LCC is a very, very important nonpartisan body here that has a significant role in this process. We have a very, very important role to play, but the first thing is we have to follow the law. And Mr. Chair, I just want to qualify, your intent is to abide by the open meeting law, not skirt it.
Exactly right.
Absolutely. We have been very, very careful in this body because we're governed by a much more difficult open meeting law to abide by than the LCCMR. And I think this body's been very transparent, very open. But there is a significant role for the LCC. And I got to be honest, I don't even know which is the chair. It reverses back and forth from the Speaker of the House and the Majority Leader in the Senate. I don't know if it's Speaker Thiessen or Senator Bach, but they are the ones that are the head of the LCC because of their role in the legislature. And it's a very important position when you deal with nonpartisan because it needs to be done in a nonpartisan way, which the LCC is. And so it's a tough process, and we want a really good person, but there's a significant role for LCC in following the law, which we must do.
Scott?
I would be the first to admit that I do not understand the internal workings of the LCC and the statutes that guide us to its utilization. But if there's one part of this process that I do think I understand, that I do struggle with, is the fact that you have eliminated the ability for anybody that's been on the council since its inception to be part of the process. Okay, I agree that we, in theory, might hire one executive director that will last for the entire balance of the term of the constitutional amendment. Okay, this is an important decision. I feel left out, and I'm not even saying it would be me. I think that to arbitrarily eliminate all of those people that have the most experience on the council or at least the longest tenure is a mistake. And if there's one part of the process that would change, that would be one thing that I very much would like to see changed, to allow at least the opportunity to poll a few people and say, you know, are you interested in participating in this process that might have a little longer tenure that I think has value in helping make that decision. So that's probably, again, I don't understand the LCC and its workings, and they do certain things, but I think that to say only people that are going to be here in 2 years are eligible or qualify, I don't think that's accurate. I think that's a mistake, and that should be changed.
Greg, do you have anything you want to add to this? This is the person who's going to be on the hot seat. You don't have to. Okay. You know, I respect the opinion. I simply disagree. And I think it's important to recognize this is really difficult under the open meeting law to get this figured out. And I've worked with the LCC to create a process where the ultimate decision rests with the entire council. I will tell you it's uncomfortable for a candidate to be interviewed by this group with an audience out there listening to how they're responding. It's a very tough process. to put someone through. If we get to the point where we have too early in the process a process that identifies who is applying, we will get people who will not want to apply because they don't want to jeopardize their current jobs. So it's really tough with the open meeting law to do this in a way that satisfies everyone. I feel very strongly, because I've hired many executive directors and been part of search committees. The question that is almost always asked is, who am I working with? You know, are you part of the group that I'm going to be working with? It's really tough to not have that. Now, the panel's job, the only job, is to narrow the candidates from 10 to 3. It's not any more than that. The 3 or 2 that come to this full body are going to be fully interviewed by everyone. So the expertise of the people who've been on the council for a while is going to be in the room at that time, and that's the point of decision. We're going to interview candidates, and we're going to get to the point of having the discussion about, I like this person better than that person, in front of the audience. And everyone will have an opportunity at that point to have an opinion and help frame the decision to hire one of the people that are presented, or to say, we don't like any of them, go back and find someone else. So that expertise will be drawn upon. The funneling process is the only place where it doesn't, but the ultimate decision does. So, Jim?
Well, I couldn't disagree with you more, David. And I think you've really overstepped your bounds here. You have no authority to set this process up. But the argument about the open meeting law is irrelevant. We could have these meetings right here, just like we're doing today, and be well within the law. As far as the interviews of the finalists, that's not what I'm talking about. I don't think that needs to be done in this forum here. But the process and the bringing these people forward and willowing them down to the people that we're going to eventually see should be done by the whole council, not a select group that you selected yourself. As far as whose people are working with, that's an irrelevant argument as well, because you know those people could be there for 2 years. So, what difference does that make? I think this is really way out of bounds.
Right. This is following the procedure that hired the director the first time around. It's in line with that. This council cannot set up a committee that will be not subject to the open meeting law. An advisory panel, which Greg has agreed to, which he doesn't have to, by the way, is not an official committee of this body and therefore not subject to the open meeting law. I guess if you don't like my procedure, you can remove me as chair, but it is what we're going to do unless you do that. Ready? Yep.
I do think that this is a fair process, and I think the only other alternative to the process that David has outlined is to pull it completely out of the council's hands until it's down to the final interviews, where the full council is going to be participating one way or the other. The advisory panel, for my reading of the statute, is totally optional. That's not something you can force, Jim. That's not something the council can force. That's a choice that the LCC has to give us or not give us. And I think you just need to back off. And that's my opinion.
Elizabeth?
Thank you. In hiring, generally, at least the hiring I've been involved with, generally the people who do the hiring and the winnowing down and the review of candidates are the people who will be in charge of evaluating and supervising that candidate as they become the employee. So I'm wondering, I do believe that LCC is in charge of the evaluation of the employee. Can Bill, can you give us some light on, or can Greg give us some light on the LCC and what happens with the employee, who's in charge of what?
The procedures of the council address the question of evaluation. And the chair evaluates the council, or the executive director, and in conjunction with the LCC.
So then, to me, it would seem very important that the chair and the LCC determine the process and be an important part of that process. Okay, go ahead, Bill. I think I interrupted you.
I think the important thing about where we sit is we're created as a creature of the legislature. We're a legislative body. Our appropriation goes to the legislature for all things like travel policy, travel approval of expenditures, contracting, and things like that. They're all done at the blessing of the LCC. So evaluation is one aspect of this. And it's a, as far as I'm concerned, a joint evaluation. I don't know if that helps you. Tom?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I too like the process that you've outlined here and am very comfortable with it. I think it's important that we realize that we aren't picking the chairman of Ducks Unlimited, executive director of Ducks Unlimited here. We're picking a state employee, and the reason the LCC was put into effect was so that the open meeting law, outside the open meeting law, so some confidential things could be accomplished without the problems that that Bill talks about here, and that's having good candidates and having their confidence while they're being there.
Jim?
Aren't we supposed to have a personnel committee that evaluates the executive director? Part of our operating?
That's not, as I recall, the duty of the personnel committee. Let me check, and I'll get back to you as we go forward on this.
Scott? You know, there's been lots of conversation about the role of the LCC, and I don't think there's anybody here that thinks they shouldn't be involved. They're going to be involved. That's part of the requirements we have. I think the issue really comes down to is the makeup of the advisory or evaluation panel, and the fact that, I mean, it was decided that this is how it's going to go. These are the people that are going to be on it. You can take it or leave it. And that I kind of struggle with that a little bit. I think that we're not going to get into any open meeting law issues. No one's asking to do that. Okay, nobody's asking to remove the LCC from the process. Basically, I'm just saying that the council, If individual members would like to be involved in the process to narrow the panel of candidates to three or four, that they should be able to do that. And that doesn't breach any of the confidentiality of the applicant. That doesn't breach or involve any issues with the open meetings law or the LCC or any other such thing. It just allows the council members who want to be involved in helping narrow the field to do so. And I think that request is reasonable.
Okay, any other discussion on this? If not, we'll move to Executive Director's report.
Over the time since the last meeting, we have been working, as you'll see later in the agenda, on scoring and making sure that scoring lines up with the request and that sort of thing, and that we have a good translation from the criteria in the request for funding to the scoring. We've also, a lot of our time has been involved in bill presentation and making sure that people have the right information that is committee members have a thorough understanding of both the bill as a whole and any particular questions in the, about the bill. We have also been working on things like understanding the February forecast and looking into spending progress. We will soon get to you, I will, a report on the parcels that we've acquired. There are upwards of 200 parcels. We've spent $65 million on acquisition of conservation easements and fee simple acquisition. We'll get that report to you before the next meeting. We do have some concern about the rate of spend in these programs. We try to watch that, and we're liable to have to ask people to do a little introspection and figure out how to speed things up. So I would also just like to mention that you have received a copy of the executive director draft position as prepared, I think it is correct, in 2008 and reviewed by LCC prior to the hiring of the current executive director, that would be me, and then reviewed again in a cursory manner, awaiting your ideas. This is similar to other equivalent positions in the LCC workforce. And I think that's an important thing about that. So, that is the executive director's report. I'll stand for questions. I would like to defer questions on the progress on the bill and February forecast and those sorts of things until they are reached in the agenda, unless somebody has a burning question.
Any questions for Bill? If not, I'd like to ask Rick and Tom to talk about where our bill is at, if you're willing to do that.
Tom's report is shorter.
but you had all the action, so why don't you pick it up?
And if Denny could help if I miss something. But you should have a copy of the bill in front of you, and it's been through two committees. There have been changes to the bill. I want to make that clear. There have been changes, primarily word changes, one appropriation change that relates to the Shell Rock project that we talked about previously. So I'm going to go through. First changes were related to the definitions of the federal government programs. So we have WRP, and we have to change those to the current definitions whenever we're citing that. And I think we have a correction going back to the prior appropriations as well, so statute is correct. We had some appropriations that were down to below $1,000 in terms of like $860 or something like that. So we have to round those up to the nearest thousand. So that's a technical correction. Next one where we get into some substance is on grazing. In the first committee, we had opposition from the ag interests on our grazing appropriations. There was quite a bit of discussion about that. There was a motion to remove all of the grazing language that we had. I did not want that to happen. I put in an alternative that said if there is a grazing plan that is currently in operation, it's not stopped. Because the way it was written, it could be considered that you know, there could be an emergency declaration, therefore, if you're already grazing, you have to stop. So if you look on the appropriations, let's say pick the first one, the DNR management wildlife, 2.26, where it says conservation grazing under a management plan that is already being implemented may continue. That's new language that appears on each of the 14 grazing appropriations.
This was a stroke of genius from Rick in terms of how to avoid having all reference to emergency grazing removed from this. And it's not much of a kind of a modification to say it can continue if it's part of an accomplishment plan or a conservation plan. So it was a little fix to a big problem. There was a lot of opposition.
And there were questions, and I think this, because it's a clause on each of the appropriations, some of the discussion was, well, you put this in 14 times. You're picking on grazing. Well, we didn't do that. It's on each appropriation where there's potential grazing because this is session law rather than statute. So it's not going backward. We're not picking on anybody. It's related to each of these appropriations in this bill. If a future council or a future doesn't want to do it, it's not in statute. It's in the appropriation.
Jim, do you have a question? Representative Hansen, last year when they had the emergency hazing, hay and grazing, the DNR said, well, it was okay because most of those areas we had conservation plans. So, I mean, is this really going to do what we want then? I mean, because if every piece of public land has a grazing in their management plan, they're going to just do it anyway, in our opinion.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Cox, I don't believe it does. I mean, I think this gives us still the protection. So if somebody's out there doing it already, rather than start, that's clear.
Bill? We've looked at the grazing plans that have been prepared. They're quite detailed. They talk about the month, the week of the month. They divide the areas up into different types of cover, so you can't just graze freely. You're grazing in a certain place. And if all the plans are like the ones we've seen, this is a habitat-oriented step according to the wildlife managers.
I think I understand what you're saying, Rick. If a grazing plan is currently being utilized, it can continue. But if a piece of property that might have grazing as an approved management plan, but that is not currently being grazed, okay, that one would not then be able to start an implementation. It's only if that implementation is in play.
If you read the language again, it says that it's already being implemented, may continue. And I want to be clear on this. This, and it only says conservation grazing. So often there's an emergency haying and grazing declaration. This is only grazing. They cannot hay it. So we're relating to grazing as part of management. We had a long discussion that the constitutional language talks about protecting, restoring, and enhancing, not providing food for livestock. So
this is really a great thing.
I agree.
Great job. And I just want to say, there was huge opposition. I mean, the first hearing I filled out that, it was like wagons were circled on that issue. So, Rick really bailed us out.
Then, I think in that same appropriation, there was discussion with the Vermilion River Wildlife Management. And there's testimony and discussion about this is the Semstone acquisition and the issue with the trail. And the discussions going on between the county and the DNR about separating those parcels where there was heartburn over Outdoor Heritage Fund money paying for the land that would be mining, and there was heartburn over the council approval of the trail. There was heartburn over the trail. But if you separate out other funds paying for mine. The Outdoor Heritage Fund is paying for the upland, and Dakota County paying for the trail, then there would be no need for council to approve the trail if the county funds are being used for the trail. So that was certain. But is that right, Danny? Are we? I think it was your motion, and we were both on the same path.
Yeah, I think we actually almost had the same. We didn't know it, but Janelle had actually, to show you how nonpartisan staff works, we actually both requested the exact same amendment drafted, and then I had another one drafted after looking at it. There was one more sentence, but basically the intents were the same. My concern was it put in us in a position of approving a trail that actually, under current law, is not allowed. Trails in WMAs, generally speaking, are not allowed. The commissioner can decide to support a trail, but it has to have a component of, like, access, maybe for handicap or something, to be able to fish or hunt in an area. And so it was, I think, after evaluation, that we would be better to get this out. Representative Hansen brings the point that in the end, the county may purchase some area, but it would be separate of our funds. I think we were going down, if we put in, we're starting to okay trails, that's not consistent with protect, enhance, restore. So it was, I think, a good change, and one that met. This bill actually is progressing much more smoothly this year than last year at this point.
And then, Chair and members, I think we're pretty good to go to the hourly Shell Rock River. So at the previous meeting, the council, we had a discussion about if there were funds available after the forecast, $700,000 that was needed to complete that project because the bid came in higher. And we'll get into the forecast in a bit, but also the potential of a project being canceled at the end of the year that has $577,000 potentially coming back as a fund to provide additional dollars. So based on the discussion we had at the last meeting, we moved to put that Shell Rock River $700,000 in to make that from the previous bills, make that appropriation.
Does everyone understand that? We can't actually do anything about this, but I think it might give you some cover, and Tom, maybe you, if the council were to simply acknowledge and perhaps thank you for adding that to the bill after the conversation that we had, so that it's clear to the legislature that we think this is a good idea. So if someone would be willing to make a motion that thanks Representative Hansen for adding that to the Shell Rock River appropriation, I think that would go a long way.
And I would make that, to make sure I understand, that there was some money from a prior appropriation that was possibly coming back, and Mr. Hansen took those dollars and tacked them onto the Shell Rock River to fully fund that project.
Because their estimate of construction when they made the presentation wasn't accurate to what came in.
Then I would certainly make the motion to thank Mr. Hansen for tacking on that language and making that project whole.
Sandy, would you call the any discussion?
Mr. Chair, the only thing I want to qualify, the clawback or the return of that money actually doesn't happen. It's going to happen simultaneously. Representative Hansen's amendment to add Shell Rock can't be conditioned on, even though it's a reality that other money is, from a practical standpoint, going to come back. It was not a condition because they're happening simultaneously. So you could argue that in some way, somehow, that other project, which isn't going to happen, did happen. The money would be coming out of the reserves, and it would change the reserves by 0.7%, I believe, approximately, something like that. The reality, that's not what's happening, but it wasn't a condition. It's a reality of it.
Do I need to remake the motion?
Would you make
I would like to make the motion to thank Mr. Hansen for adding on the language that makes the Shell Rock River project whole, period.
Any other discussion? Sandy, will you call the roll on that?
Representative Hansen.
Yes.
Jim Cox.
Yes.
Bob Anderson.
Yes.
Jane Kingston. Representative McNamara.
Yes.
Sue Olson. Sue? Scott Rahl.
Yes.
Senator Sexton.
Yes.
Elizabeth Wilkins.
Yes.
I say yes, too.
Oh,
thank you for doing it. I think legislatively that doesn't get us in trouble, but does show support for the change, which is important.
I think the next change is, and Janelle can correct me if I'm wrong, there's really not anything on appropriations, right? It's mainly at the end with some policy.
Mr. Chair, there were some language changes to the EIF appropriation, but otherwise, it's more than policy.
Yeah. Could you point out what page that's on? Okay, so in each of the committees, we had discussion and testimony from the public about aquatic invasive species, similar to what we had in the council, with more specificity in terms of recommendations. Rather than all of the testimony said that they supported the appropriation. Most of the testimony had difficulty with the Initiative Foundation being in the administrative role. Most of the testimony provided recommendations on different components of the appropriation or the accomplishment plan. And then I'd say another consistent question was on timing, the 5-year versus the 2-year, that they wanted to get the money out there. And instead of having 5 years to get the money out, 5 years on the evaluation, but because the need is there to get the 2 years done. So maybe, Janelle, if you could walk through the language that was added. I think it's on 1910, somewhere in there.
Mr. Chair, members, on 19.9, you'll see it now specifies including pilot project conducting education and outreach, inspection and decontamination enforcement and other activities. And then on line 19.17, there's a new sentence added. The required evaluation must evaluate the efficacy of inspection and decontamination activities utilized in any of the pilot projects in preventing the spread of aquatic invasive species. And then there were some oral amendments just regarding the availability of the appropriation that apparently were not addressed. So we'll have to do that as a technical amendment in Ways and Means.
Okay. And those were saying that the implementation should be accelerated to the 2 years, with the 5 years being the evaluation. It's not spend money over 5 years. We want to get this spent for
which
the project.
Was always the intention anyhow. This is just really a clarification, as well as a clarification that inspection and decontamination can be part of the suite of a pilot project versus it not being specifically called out.
And maybe, Bill, if you could say where the language came from.
We consulted, staff consulted with project managers over time and determined that this was acceptable to them and that it could be incorporated into the accomplishment plan prior to our acceptance of that in June. Is that what you were thinking about? Okay.
This language was added in Representative Kahn's committee. The question came up relating to the conservation. We think there's a drafting error on lands in the Metro Grant Program says subject to state law, land acquired in fee given hunting fishing during the open season unless otherwise provided by state law, and the constitutional language is law. So I think there was a draft in there that was hoping to correct that in the way that it is. I'd say the most substantive change would be, you know, where's the assessed value acquisition process on 28?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, it'd be sections 3 and 4.
On page 28, before that, before section 3, is looking at subdivision 10 pollinators. That's language that is cross references with the statute that was passed this year. So it's putting that in session law to make sure that everybody knows that there's pollinators. And I'm there, so. My position. Now you want to walk through the section 3 and section 4.
Mr. Chair, section 3 would change the process that the DNR would go through when acquiring land using any legacy fund, including the Elkhart Heritage Fund. They'd be limited if you look on page 29.7. They cannot agree to pay more than the county assessor's most recent estimated market value, unless the commissioner makes a determination that the acquisition is a high priority in the document. And then section 4 applies to like minimal value acquisitions of the DNR, allowing them to skip the appraisal process and pay either the most recent assessed value or, you know, the last purchase price. And this subdivision would not apply to, again, any acquisitions funded with legacy funds. And then would you like me to continue for section 5?
The section 5 is related to the restoration evaluations. Instead of up to 1/10, it says at least 1/10. It does not affect this year's appropriation. This would be a statutory change. Section 6.
Section 6, you may recognize this language. This was passed by the House last session on the bill. It requires commissioner approval for acquisitions that will be held by the DNR. And it does exempt pork, water, and soil resources conservation easements from the commissioner approval. And then there's some new language this year that would require the recipient to request the approval within 10 business days. And then section 7, again, this was passed by the House last session. This would require the most recent tax assessed value to be submitted to the council and the DNR. And again, there's a special provision for all their conservation easements. The board is hard to keep those on file.
So section 6 and 7 were passed in the Environmental Finance Committee. That language had been in its current law with the LCCMR. Section 3 and 4 were passed in the Legacy Committee. They were Representative Green. So Representative Green modified by Representative Bouguinius' provision in that committee. And then the final thing was Article 2, which made this their backup. I think when we get through the discussion about funds, the Elkhart Heritage Fund has a reserve because we make sure we have a reserve. The other funds don't have a reserve or a substantive reserve. And so there will not be any legacy, any other appropriations on clean water, parks, or arts or history this year because there's not any funds for any supplemental appropriation. Carver County came with a modification to an appropriation, and that was added on to Representative Tom's committee, and Representative McNary may have a little more information to give you on the details of that, or that private county had. It's appeared, this, my understanding is it's not something new, but it's a modification of the existing appropriation.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Hansen, and Mr. Chair and members. The presenter, at first there was some confusion. This widens, as Representative Hansen said, this widens the bill to be an entire legacy bill, or at least include parks and trails, because they had a two-year funding last year. But this is a project with the Met Council, it's through the Met Council grant program in parks and trails, where they had a project that was going to be ready to go this year, and the other project could wait till next year. So they asked Met Council, and Met Council supports them moving the funding from one project to the other. It needed legislative approval to do that. And as Representative Hansen already said, that's why it was included in here. It was just kind of came up at the last moment, so it was it needed some discussion in the committee about what actually was involved. And so I think it's non-controversial. The only thing that happened in the committee, Mr. Stephan from Met Council was not at the meeting, was not available, so they wanted to clarify. So he was going to get back to Chair Kahn that the Met Council supported the transition, and that was the way it was approved. So it's not something that actually affects our commission here, but it is in our bill now, I guess you could say.
Great. So thanks for that clarification. Any questions on what's going on in the House? This is in Ways and Means on Monday. So this is the first time the House has gotten close to passing our bill early in the session, I think since we started. They've very quickly done this.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and while it has moved forward, and I think really the only one I'd want to mention, and it was a project that has quite wide support, but the only question it would be is the Fond du Lac project and how the ownership is. I do anticipate that there'll be further discussion about that. Where the project has broad bipartisan support, I believe, for the project moving forward. There's some question about the ownership, but it is moving forward. I think in the end, in the scheme of things, it's a rather small part, but it's one that raises some controversy among some folks, and it did in this body also, so that controversy does continue a little bit, but I think in the scheme of things, most of the bill is really moving forward, and hopefully it'll be able to happen early, which would allow all the people on the bill to get their money quicker and move this process, so it's encouraging.
We could actually be approving accomplishment plans much earlier than we have in the past, which means people can be more ready to go July 1st than months ago than in the past. But Tom, how's it going on your side?
Well, I think that it's going, it's very traditional the way it's happening. The bill was, of course, it was put in the Finance Committee, Senator Cohen's committee, and he referred to the Division on Environmental Resources, as he always does. And that's Senator Tomasoni's committee. We don't have to worry about deadlines, particularly with what happened in the House, but generally it's an exception anyway, so I wouldn't expect it'll be anything will probably be heard in the next week, probably the week after either, because we aren't dealing with deadlines. And as you know, traditionally the Senate is not has been is open to changes from what was recommended by the Lasard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council. I could certainly see a couple of exceptions this year. One probably Albert Lee, particularly with the action that you just took. And certainly what I just heard about the grazing would be something else that would probably be acknowledged, and I wouldn't be surprised to see if that could be put in the bill before a conference committee. But I think it'll come along very nicely. So it's just not going to be as quickly right now. Since we don't traditionally work quite as hard on changes, it probably doesn't need.
So we're moving forward, Rick.
Well,
I would just encourage. I would hope that we could do this without a conference. I think if the session is going to be short, I would certainly hope that the bill is not part of the 900-page omnibus bill at the end, where it's conferenced as part of the finance bill. I think that would not be good, because then it gets into a variety of other issues. We're going to move it through Ways and Means. That means it could be brought up on the floor next week. So then the focus will be on the Senate, I guess, to do it. But I think it would be unproductive to conference on some technical corrections. I recognize that the language relating to the assessments and that is going to have some controversy, and hopefully that can be worked out. But there's a lot of issues that I could see waiting, separate from our bill, going to the end of session, and I hope that this would not be one that's tangled up in that. So,
any questions?
I guess my comment was, there's one way to have a no conference committee, and that's to have a non-controversial bill.
So. I'm going to let you guys work that.
But anyway, the one thing I was going to say, as long as we're talking about the legislature potential bills, is that we've spent a lot of time in the last year or two talking about aquatic invasive species. And I've been one who is very concerned about terrestrial invasive species, particularly as they relate to emerald ash borer, gypsy moth, and who knows what's coming down the pike. We can all see things crawling through our forests and plains. So I think that I'm carrying a bill in the Senate. It's actually Andrew Falk's bill in the House that it deals with a similar situation with aquatic invasive species, and appropriating money for the University of Minnesota to do studies. I think that terrestrial invasive species is every bit as dangerous as aquatic. So I just throw that out there because I'm sure it's going to come to see us on the project.
We've never seen anything for buckthorn.
No.
Mr. Chair, a question I have. If the council would make a motion and that would pass that we would adopt the grazing language as it's currently written in the House bill, would that then make it part of the bill and thus then not be a technical change that the Senate would have to deal with? Is that something we could do to ease that process?
We have no power to do that. We could indicate an endorsement of the change, much as we did with Shell Rock River, to sort of pass a message along, but we have no influence on it once we've submitted our bill January 15th. It's out of our hands, I guess. But if you'd like to make a motion endorsing the change that the House has put in the bill with regard to grazing, that's certainly appropriate.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea.
I would like to do that. I would like to make a motion that we adopt the grazing language.
That we acknowledge.
Already acknowledged that we like.
That we like the change to the grazing language.
Correct.
I think it's an improvement.
Mr. Chair, did I just ask, and I might have missed it. Representative Hansen, did we add some language also about pollinators that I think was good language?
He mentioned it. Yeah.
Oh, that's already been mentioned? The commission supported that language also?
Which we haven't, but I surely will.
I'm just thinking it might be beneficial.
Sure. So your motion is to...
For the council to approve the changes to the grazing language and pollinator language in that we support it completely.
To endorse.
Endorse, yes.
All right. Any discussion? Sandy, will you call the roll?
Representative McNamara.
Yes.
Stu Olson.
Yes.
Scott Raw.
Yes.
Senator Saxop.
She said yes.
Yes.
Elizabeth Wilkin.
Yes.
Bob Anderson.
No.
Jim Cox.
No.
Representative Hansen.
Yes.
Jared Hartwell.
Yes.
Jane Kingston.
Yes.
8-2.
8-2. Motion passes. Any other questions on the bill and its progress?
I'd just like to thank those who have been involved in moving this forward, including our two legislative members and Ms. Coop, who's done the presentation. It's been an easy bill for me. I've enjoyed watching, so thank you.
So with that, an hour late, we're going to get to an update on the farm bill. Bill, thank you for your patience. Sorry to screw up your day somewhat. We thought it'd be important to get, as part of a series probably, information on what the new farm bill has in terms of conservation provision, and how it might affect things that we have done or will be doing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Given that we are behind and I've got 24 slides, I can blow through the slides and we can hold questions till the end, or I can take questions as we go. It's up to you how you'd like to handle it.
I think we'll just handle it as we normally do. If there are big questions that come up, we'll ask the questions.
Very good.
Mr. Chair,
members, my name is Bill Penning. I'm the Conservation Easement Section Manager with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And what I'm going to present to you today is an overview of the federal farm bill that recently passed, at least what we know about it so far. And I'd like to acknowledge right now that I heavily plagiarized from a slideshow that was given by USDA in Washington to the states and provided to me. I did edit it to sort of take out the federal procedural stuff that's more important to them than it is to us. I'm going to kind of jump around to a few subjects here as we go, but one of the things that was done in this farm bill was that conservation compliance was relinked to crop insurance, which has been a long-term goal in the original first couple versions of the farm bill. That was in there. It was taken out, I believe, in the 96 farm bill. And it's been a long-term goal by the conservation community to get that relinked to crop insurance. In other words, if you are doing what's affectionately known as sod busting or swamp busting, you are not eligible to receive crop insurance payments. You are out of compliance. So that's a good thing that occurred in the new farm bill. Pollinators, as it has been on the state level, is also an important issue at the federal level. Language from the 2008 Farm Bill was extended through 2018 in this Farm Bill. USDA will at some point provide recommendations to Congress regarding how to better coordinate federal agency efforts to address the decline of honeybees and native pollinators. So that will continue to be a hot issue for on the federal level as well as the state. CRP was reauthorized, which is a big deal. It's our most important conservation program that we have. When this farm bill was originally started to be negotiated, there was talk of not reauthorizing CRP at all. This got started after the economy crashed, and this was one of the ways that the federal government was looking at saving money. So the fact that it was reauthorized was a great thing. It was, however, reduced from 32 million acres to 24 million acres, and that will occur over the next 5 years, although my understanding is that right now we are at roughly 24 million acres enrolled. We still will have expiring CRP and could dip below that and likely will. It'll be incumbent upon us to try to get the enrollment back up to the authorized 24 million acres. Something new is that this within the CRP program, there's now a 2 million acre reserve for grasslands without cropping history. So these are going to be things such as pastures. Another thing, under the new rules that will be forthcoming for CRP, more managed haying and grazing as part of a conservation plan will be allowed. The wildlife community has felt that this is a good thing. It's been on the national agenda to get that done because of the fact that under the Farm Bill, there's mid-contract management that's required to be done twice during a 10-year contract, and there's been difficulty in getting landowners to do that. And the reason why is because you go to a farmer and you tell them you can't graze this because you're going to sell your cows and you're going to make a buck. And we want you to hay this. We want disturbance to keep the grassland vital. We want you to hay this. We want you to remove the hay. And then we want you to destroy it because we don't want you to make a buck. And to get landowners to do that, they just gridlock. They won't do it. And so we believe that by allowing them to use management and grazing and utilize the hay that comes off of there, they will be a much higher level of compliance with mid-contract management. So I think that is a good thing in the new firm, though. Easement programs, there's been some big changes within the easement programs. The Farmland and Ranchland Protection Program, FRPP, the Grassland Reserve Program, GRP, and the Wetlands Reserve Program, WRP, have been repealed. They no longer exist. What this really is, though, is a consolidation of federal easement programs into a new and larger program called the Agricultural Conservation Easement Program, or ACEP. So within ACEP, we will see what was FRPP, GRP, and WRP replaced. Within ACEP, there are two components. There are agricultural land easement components, which is what was FRPP and GRP. Think of these as the working land components of ACEP. And then there's also the new WRE, Wetlands Reserve and Easement component, and think of that as the replacement for WRP. So the purposes of ACEP are to combine and coordinate the functions of the three programs, restore and protect and enhance wetland and eligible lands, protect agricultural use viability and related conservation values of eligible lands by limiting non-agricultural uses, that's the ALE part, and protect grazing uses and related conservation values by restoring and conserving eligible land, that's also the ALE part. ACEP has been funded at $400 million in federal fiscal year 14, which ends on October 1st. The funding will increase to $500 million in fiscal year by fiscal year 2017, and then reduce to $250 million near the end of the bill. During 2014, fiscal 2014, USDA plans to develop and publish ACEP regulations to administer ACEP in fiscal year 15 and subsequent fiscal years. So we have some new provisions within the Farm Bill that will require new federal rules. Developing and publishing federal rules is a big deal, and it takes a long time. So we will continue to have some uncertainty for the future here on what's going to happen.
Are these all term easements, or are these permanent easements?
It depends upon the program. And I will actually hit that a little bit of that as I go forward here. some changes in the WRE program that are different from what was in the last version of WRP is that the ownership requirement has been reduced from 7 years to 2 years, which I believe is what it was in some of the earlier farm bills, and then it was increased to 7 years. I think that that is a good thing. We occasionally bumped into parcels of land where somebody wants to enroll into what was WRP, and the only thing that's stopping them is this requirement that they've owned the land for 7 years. And in terms of getting habitat out of the ground, you know, if they own it for a month, that's fine with me. This also authorizes a waiver process to allow enrollment of CRP lands, established trees, just that's sort of a minor thing in Minnesota. And there's no option to enroll standalone restoration cost share agreements, which actually is something that has not been used in Minnesota in the past anyways. It will affect some other states, but not us quite so much. So within, I'm going to back up a slide here, within WRE, it's likely that we will see an enrollment on the federal side in 2014, sometime this late summer, perhaps. I'm speculating now. And it will be look very similar to what WRP was in the past, with the exception of these new rules. And the reason that I'm speculating to that regard is that they've got $400 million to get out the door by October 1st. So they can't possibly write new rules for everything in that time period. So I think they're going to have to do some extension, allowing old rules to continue forward with some slight modifications. The new Farm Bill, so this is a part some comments on the ALE program, that what was GRP, they are no longer allowed to do. However, the GRP purposes are now combined within ALE. A very significant thing with this Farm Bill is that there is a new requirement for ALE of a 50% match and a local sponsor. I think that this will be a huge opportunity for Minnesota to get some grassland acres. Traditionally, what was GRP mostly went to the western states. I don't think that there are many western states that are positioned as we are with dedicated funding and partnerships that are ready to implement these programs. So I think that this is a huge opportunity for us. We have traditionally not had many GRP acres in Minnesota, and they have been short-term contracts rather than permanent easements, and I think that we can turn those into permanent easements. In terms of WRP and the new WRE, NRCS will continue to hold easements. They'll keep the WRP compensation and eligibility framework from the 2008 Farm Bill, which means that they'll use the same methodology for calculating their payment rates and what constitutes an eligible project in WRE will be similar to what was eligible under WRP. And priority for enrollment continues to be based on value of the easement for protecting and enhancing habitat for migratory birds and other wildlife. So that basic tenant of WRP has continued on into WRE. For WRE, there are three enrollment options, permanent, a 30-year easement, and a 30-year contract to Indian tribes. This is similar to what was eligible under a WRP in terms of options. The 2014 Act requires that new enrollments are made using WRE authorities rather than WRP authorities. And again, we're going to be in a little bit of a catch-22 here because they don't have the rules written. But you'll hear us starting to talk more and more about WRE and less about WRP. This is the second bullet here. Is straight from the feds, and it was at the end of February. Transition guidance to address funding for prior year enrollment activities as well as new FY14 enrollments is forthcoming. They sent out a bulletin on Tuesday, I think, saying that anything that was already funded and in the pipeline for WRP will continue forward. That means we'll be able to close easements that are in the pipeline. We'll also be able to do the restoration work on those easements under existing authorities. Something completely new in this farm bill are Regional Conservation Partnership Programs, RCPP. The RCPP is a new regional program that furthers conservation, restoration, and sustainable use of soil, water, wildlife on a regional scale, encourages partners to cooperate with producers, and provides assistance through partnership agreements. In this case, that could be the state with USDA. And it combines and replaces the purposes and functions of previous partnerships. There were two of them in the last farm bill that affected Minnesota. One was MRBI, the Mississippi River Basin Initiative, and the other one was the Upper Great Lakes Initiative. So those programs no longer exist under those names, but it's likely that they will reappear as RCPPs. The RCPPs utilize existing programs within the Farm Bill, such as ASEP, which we just talked about again, which is the ALE and the WRE components, EQIP, CSP, and HFRP, which is actually a program that's not been used hardly at all in Minnesota. Funding available. So in addition to the $400 million that they have this year for implementation of ALE, there's another $100 million of direct RCPP funding each year throughout the life of the Farm Bill, so that's another $500 million, plus 7% of the funds from each of the covered programs are held in reserve to be used by the RCPPs through April 1st of each year. So that means that if you are a part of an RCPP, you get an additional allotment of acres. And if you can burn those acres up by April 1st, nobody else gets a crack at them. The funding allocation, the way this is going to work for RCPPs, is that 25% of the allocation will go to state projects. Not entirely sure what that means yet. I think that what that means is that the state con and the director for FSA will be able to allocate their 25% as they see fit for partnerships with better for kind of statewide level. 40% will be allocated for nationally important projects, and 35% for projects in what are called critical conservation areas, which is also a new aspect of the Farm Bill. Critical conservation areas, the secretary will select up to 8 of these critical conservation areas, and priority consideration will be given to geographical areas which include multiple states with significant ag production, have an existing agreement or work plans, benefit water quality and quantity improvement, and assist producers to meet natural resource regulatory requirements. This will be, I think, an opportunity for us perhaps to work with neighboring states in developing partnerships that go outside of Minnesota. That's always a difficult thing to do. We've got at least one that's ongoing right now and is likely a shoe-in to be one of the 8 designated critical conservation areas, and that's the Red River Valley. They've been working cross-border there for quite some time. They anticipated this coming in the Farm Bill, and this is important to Congressman Peterson. It's also potentially possible that the MRBI area could also be designated as a critical conservation area, and we also may have other opportunities to try to get yet an additional one designated in Minnesota, for instance, if we wanted to do a very pothole one with the Dakotas and Iowa, although we'd be extremely lucky to get 3 out of the 8 in Minnesota. NRCS is going to implement RCPP through partnership agreements. They will have a competitive process to select applicants for the partnership agreements, and they'll make public their criteria that they used in evaluating these partnership proposals. This is an area of which I just told you everything I know about it, and nobody else knows anything about it either. This is brand new, and they're going to have to make it up as they go. They have put some caveats on it. Those partners are responsible for contributing a significant portion of the overall costs, conducting outreach and education, leveraging financial or technical assistance provided by NRCS with additional funds to help achieve the project objectives, conducting and providing an assessment of the project costs and conservation effects, and no funding may be used to cover partner administrative costs. There seems to be much more emphasis in this farm bill on leveraging local dollars than there has been in the past. Traditionally, USDA has, in some cases, paid 100% of the freight on projects like CRP, and they seem to be looking for ways to stretch their federal dollars, both through actual cash match by local partners as well as using staffing capacity of local partners. And I think that this is something that we should start looking at now and trying to figure out how we can be first in line when we have opportunities here. And RCPP supposedly will be implemented this year, and additional guidance on fund distribution and program management will be provided. And again, that's pretty much all I know on RCPP. A couple last things here. The BPA HIP, which was $50 million over 5 years in the last farm bill, this is what you call walking access in Minnesota, has been reauthorized at $40 million over 5 years in this farm bill. And I know that that's not directly relevant to what LSOHC does, but it is an opportunity for landowners to look at their finance sheets when they're thinking about going into a program like WRP or CRP and adding a few bucks to it. So I think it's a good thing for us that this money is available, and I think that with our new walk-in program, we're positioned to get some of those dollars. With that, I would stand for any questions that you might have, or you can shoot me an email or give me a call later.
David?
Yes.
Just a quick comment, if it's a convenient time.
Fine.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks for all the new acronyms. And just want to encourage you to put together something for the Prairie Potholes. Having three potential candidates for critical conservation should certainly ensure all the strength of all three, or at least, you know, one of them. So thank you. And go for the Prairie Pothole.
Mr. Chair, members, there have already been discussions at commissioner levels about trying to figure out how we can leverage opportunities within this new farm bill. In fact, there was a meeting a couple weeks ago that I think was perhaps unique and never happened before, in that it was the commissioners of DNR, PCA, Agriculture, John Jasky, the director of Bowser, Don Ballone, the state con from NRCS, and Jeff Crusoe from FSA, all in the same room at the same time, talking about how we can work together to maximize getting federal dollars to do the best conservation that we can in Minnesota. It was a pretty enthusiastic meeting. There are also lots of big ideas, and now it's going to be our job to sort through all of that and try to figure out how to make this thing work.
Scott.
When CRP got reauthorized and now they have some options to pay that and take the money, how did that affect the payment rate? Hopefully payment rates for CRP went up to encourage participation, but do they take a knockback if they're going to profit from those acres?
Mr. Chair, Scott, I don't know if I can answer that yet because I don't think the rules have been written, but in the past, when emergency haying and grazing has been authorized on CRP, they've had to take a reduction if they exercise that option. So I think that something like that may occur again. Or it may be considered to be a management activity and they're not being let. Say they hay it once every 3 years, which would be considered to be a mid-contract management activity, and in fact was encouraged under the last farm bill. They just wanted them to destroy the hay. So I guess I don't really know the answer. It could go either way.
Jim?
Yeah, Bill, I'm curious. When will we know the specifics of these new programs? And how much money, legacy money, will this affect?
Mr. Chair, Jim, the federal rules are to be published sometime during the next year, and I think they'll come out in chunks. They'll probably start with the easiest stuff being essentially programs that haven't changed much from one farm bill to the next, and then they'll have to delve into the more complex ones as they go. In terms of how much legacy money will this affect, I mean, I can't answer that. If we're talking, you know, like one-to-one leveraging or something like that, it could be hundreds of millions of dollars if we wanted to invest that.
Yeah.
I guess my question is, how much legacy money that's already been appropriated will this affect?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Cox, I'm not entirely sure that I can answer that question. What I can say is that on the Bowser appropriations, we've positioned ourselves so that we can fully utilize existing dollars in the new programs.
This is a good question, Mr. Chair. We'll get the answer. My recollection from our discussions was it's two appropriations, but the one two back was partially committed. So I think the answer is the last appropriation, the one that's under recommendation now, in the 2012. And I can't tell you how much money that is, but it's probably $30 million.
Mr. Becker, and that's specific to the Bowser appropriations, and I thought, Jim, your question was broader to sort of all OHF appropriations, and that's why I hedged on that, because I'm not sure how much money that's going to other organizations is affected by this.
Scott?
If I understood it correctly, under these new programs, the match that we have is like a 50-50. I mean, we get a dollar for every dollar we put in. Under our old WRP that we funded in those the appropriations that we're talking about, the federal matches on those were way higher. I think like $2.3 for every dollar.
It was about anywhere between $1.51, $1.56, something like that under WRP. Okay,
so we've lost about a third of our leverage then with these changes. When we made those decisions based on, you know, those matches and those kinds of things, is there any way to, how much of those dollars were committed under the old program that would still be eligible for the 2-to-1 instead of the 1-to-1?
As a point of clarification, the 50% match requirement is for the ALE programs, which was GRP, which we have not utilized and matched with Outdoor Heritage Funds, to the best of my knowledge, in this state. Okay. In the past. Leveraging and matching under WRE, we don't know exactly what that's going to be yet, but it'll probably be similar to what it is now.
Thank you.
So hold that question, it'll come back.
See if I can remember it long enough.
Yeah. Bill, thanks.
I'm going to ask Mr. Kohler to say
quickly
a few words here.
We'll move on.
Mr. Chairman and members, just real quick, and Bill was trying to answer Mr. Cox's question. What Representative Hansen mentioned is that the language change for the phase 4, the 12 money and the 13 money and the money that's being considered right now We generalized it to just say USDA. Yeah. So existing approvals that the council and the legislature have made, the new farm bill now being enacted, we're fine to continue to work. We took out WRP knowing that it wasn't going to be called WRP, so that was, Mr. Cox, the existing approaches are fine. I mean, it's the point that if we do a phase 7, you know, we'll call it WRE, not WRP. Okay. So I just wanted to clarify that, Bill. Sorry.
Okay.
All right. Thanks very much for coming in and helping to let us understand changes.
You're welcome. I practiced the acronyms for a couple of days before.
We'll blindfold you and see how well you got. Next is a report we're going to shorten up on restoration evaluation. I know Wade had a PowerPoint for us, which he's going to maybe come back another time to give because we're running late. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Hartwell and Council. For the record, Wade Johnson, Department of Natural Resources. As Chair Hartwell mentioned, I'm going to give you cliff notes this morning and come back maybe in the coming months and talk to you in a little more detail about some of the output stuff from the program. I guess just right off the top to reiterate that the evaluation process to the Outdoor Heritage Funds and establishing the projects or achieving their planned goals, essentially whether or not these funds are strategic conservation investments. And then using that process to learn what works, what doesn't, and in that process, advance restoration practice by feeding back the lessons learned to practitioners and decision makers in a meaningful way. I guess quickly to jump into the Outdoor Heritage Fund projects that have been involved in the evaluation process to date. You'll look at page 2 on your handout there. There's a little spreadsheet list of projects, local projects to date, and a few more that are going to be picked up this field season 2014. You'll see this is broken out by what appears in fiscal year reports by programs. Programs being those, large appropriations, and then the individual project sites that were actually looked at under those larger appropriations, are listed out there. I won't deliver that. I guess jumping back on the first page to think about where we are taking this process, some of the outputs that we're planning in the coming months, specifically this year. Well, at first, it's been almost 2 years now that I've been in this position. It's been a process of building the program, getting out in the field, conducting evaluations, and starting to increase the capacity both in what we're able to produce as far as feedback. This last year, there was also an RFP process, and there's a master contract in place. I have 7 different contractors on board to be both conducting the evaluation work in the field and providing some actual more in-depth case studies of how this work is being done, with the intention that that will then further inform practice of what's going on out there and find those places where we can plug in the puzzle pieces to really improve practice. So those are coming online now, and as you can see, as council staff requested recently, that I sort of map out a timeline of how long we spent to date. You can see that there was a period of sort of building up capacity of the program over the past year and a half. Now we're in days of having increased capacity and getting a lot more field work done, and no small part due to the addition of contracted work that's now being written. In the near future, you'll be seeing the fiscal 13 report, some recommendations out of that I'll be presenting to you in the near future are some recommendations of how to improve the planning and implementation documentation, in line with what's already in statute for restoration plan, and also further recommendations of, planning tools that might be implemented as part of the process that we could apply across the board. Again, you'll be seeing that in the near future, and we can talk in a future meeting about those. With that, I'll keep it really short today and field questions from the council. Thank you. Jim?
You know, when you do your evaluations, do you only do evaluations of restorations, or do you do evaluations of our enhancements and our acquisitions, or?
Chair Hartwell and Councilmember Cox, the process that's laid out right now regarding our heritage fund, we are only looking at projects that are reported to restore.
And so why would you look at the enhancements?
Well, early on in the process, there was discussion, there were several discussions about, you know, the scope of the program and both the legislative intent and the writing of specifically the statutory writing that said restoration evaluations. And as it plays out, the discussion was, well, statute says restoration of heritage fund has restoration, enhancement, and protection. Clearly, statute says restoration, so that's the scope of the evaluation program. And certainly that's, I think, potential for an ongoing discussion.
Other questions? A good question, though, Jim, because the line between restoration and enhancement is blurry at best.
Thank you for coming in.
We'll look forward to hearing from you again.
Thank you, Chair.
Next members, we're going to hear as to what the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund bill is, with the hope that we have a little more understanding coming out of this for how what they're doing with the Environmental Trust Fund and how it might collaborate with some of the stuff we're doing going forward. So, Mike? And anything you can save us in time will be appreciated.
I will do that. Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Mike Banker, Assistant Director for the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources. So, just real briefly, they have three handouts. One was a sheet with three, double-sided with three pie charts. That's kind of an overview background information document on appropriations. One was a list of the appropriations, several pages long, has all the appropriations by subdivision, with a summary, which is essentially the appropriation language without some of the details. And finally, it's sort of an overview, two-page document that summarizes the subdivision, the outcome, and the outcomes. So as I'm referring to certain things, those are the three documents that we'll refer you to. I did have some slides, but it's not working, so I'm just going to go ahead without them. And, so, very briefly, I was going to give an update on the commission, or a reminder on who the commission is and what the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund is, and then I'll get into this year's bill. So, as you may know, the membership is 17 members, 7 citizen members, 5 appointed by the governor, 1 by the Senate, 1 by the House, 5 House members and 5 Senate members. And the commission, in some form, has been around since 1963. And since 1963, over $750 million has been appropriated over almost 1,800 projects. The Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund was created in 1988. It's Minnesota's first constitutionally dedicated fund for environment and natural resources. And it was established with 77% voter approval. It can only be used for projects of long-term benefit to Minnesota's environment and natural resources, and it originates from a combination of, the money originates from the Minnesota Lottery, which is about 40%. It's 40% of the profits of the lottery are dedicated to the trust fund. Those then get invested by the State Board of Investment, and The trust fund grows through a combination of lotteries, currently contributes about $33 million a year, and the growth from the investment is about 8% a year. And as of the end of last month, the trust fund stands at $774 million. The commission then can recommend for each fiscal year up to 5.5% of that corpus value, which is determined by June 30th of the year before the biennium. So this year, on June 30th, the value of the trust fund on June 30th will determine how much can be spent for fiscal year 16 and 17. And the language of the trust fund is that the assets of the fund shall be appropriated by law for the public purpose of protection, conservation, preservation, and enhancement of the state's air, water, land, fish, wildlife, and other natural resources. So it is a fairly broad mandate. The trust fund has had a history of investing in finding better ways to do natural resources management, improving abilities, improving methods, evaluating effectiveness, maximizing the effect, maximizing investment that the state is making in conservation, along with an array of other things. So there is a statutory reference that says what the trust fund can and cannot be spent on. I'm going to summarize that. I did have a slide that had that language, but there are essentially there's eight things, but the six things that kind of are related to natural resources are the RIM program, research to increase effectiveness of protecting and managing the state's environment or natural resources, collection and analysis of information. This is generally foundational information. It's critical to management, to prioritizing, to determining policies, guiding efforts. The state may invest in its environment and natural resources. Fourth thing, enhancement of education, awareness, understanding related to the constitutional purposes described. Number five, capital projects for preserving and protecting natural resources. That's mostly referring to land acquisition. Number six, activities that preserve or enhance natural resources from impairment or destruction. There's two other things. One is expenses of the State Board of Investment, which manages the trust fund, and the trust fund is able to cover those. And then administrative expenses for the Legislative Citizen Commission, Minister of Resources. And then there are a few things that cannot be spent on. One is environmental compensation and liability for release of pollutants and hazardous substances. Another is municipal water pollution control. Another is decommissioning of power plants, hazardous waste disposal facilities, solid waste disposal facilities, and other purposes that are inconsistent with the commission's strategic plan. So since 1991, approximately $400 million has been appropriated to over 400 projects, and these tend to be, there tends to be a greater focus on projects that have an impact throughout the state, statewide impact. So I'm now going to go through this year's bill, and you can kind of follow along in this sheet here. And what I'm going to do is talk about the bill generally, and then I'm going to focus in on a couple projects that are more specific to the purview of what this council tends to fund, and talk about kind of the projects focused on improving acquisition, restoration, enhancement, sort of where the overlap is, but I'll also give you a little overview of the bill as a whole. So there are eight subdivisions with appropriations in them. The first one is water resources. We have $4.6 million going to 13 appropriations. A lot of this money is going to research on analysis initiatives pertaining to wastewater treatment to protect our clean water, optimizing treatment methods for improving water quality, developing and testing methods to improve and enhance groundwater management, design and installation of a pilot system for using rainwater. One in particular, if you want to find on your sheet, is 3M, which is That's the wrong one. 3. Sorry. One moment. Oh, yeah, 3M. It just had the wrong project title. This is looking at the Glacial Ridge Habitat Restoration, and it's kind of looking at what are the specific effects that large-scale wetland and prairie habitat restoration has on flood reduction, water quality, and ecosystem function. And the impact then will be what to guide and improve knowledge about the most effective ways to do wetland prairie restoration, and as then it could be useful to similar efforts throughout the state. Then the next subdivision is aquatic and terrestrial invasive species. There's a 23-year history of the trust fund being investing in efforts to protect Minnesota's land and resources through doing research on aquatic and terrestrial invasive species. Last year, for example, the commission helped fund the creation of the Aquatic Invasive Species Center at the University of Minnesota. So there's 6 appropriations in this subdivision. First one is actually to the Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center, and they're going to look at ways to optimize the lock and dam systems in 2 through 8 to figure out ways that things that can be cost-effectively implemented at these sites to impede the movement of invasive carp into the upper Mississippi. And it has the potential, they think they can do some cost-effective ways of doing this and prevent statewide invasion through these processes. There's another one that's going to look at some technology. Carp have a very sensitive hearing, and so they're going to look at some technology that might can use that as a weakness of theirs in order to detect and to control them. It's a potentially inexpensive, environmentally friendly, portable option for dealing with civil carp particular is what this is what I'm looking at. The stuff they tend to react to sound, and so using that sensitivity to either move them together or capture them. We have another appropriation. This one is happening in northwest Minnesota, and it's a pilot project for doing watershed scale approach to aquatic invasive species control. And the appropriation, we actually direct them to coordinate with Outdoor Heritage Fund activities. You guys have an appropriation this year to do some pilots or regional scale aquatic invasive species, and we've actually already have the project managers from your project and our project talking. This particular project is kind of a pilot at a watershed scale and could be then used to implement statewide once they show how to coordinate better between agency jurisdictions. Next, I'm going to move to our terrestrial invasive species. We have 3 invasive species that the trust fund will be looking at this year. I'm going to continue to do some work with emerald ash borer. Trust fund's been invested in emerald ash borer research and so forth since it was first discovered in, I believe it was 2009. Additionally, there are some appropriations for brown marmorate stink bug, which currently is in isolated areas in the state, and there are some effective ways for controlling this, and they're going to implement some of those. They're going to monitor for where else it might expand the state. Another appropriation is for mountain pine beetle. It's not yet in the state, but if it gets here, it will be quite devastating. And so they're going to be surveying to see if it is possibly here already. They don't think it is, although there was a dead organism found in some wood that was imported. So they're going to assess kind of the risk to the pine species in the state, how they'll act specifically in Minnesota. Because there are about 191 million pine trees that are susceptible to the mountain pine beetle. You may be aware that this pine beetle is decimated forests in the western part of the United States since moved into Canada, and the vector by which it would come into Minnesota would probably be through the northern part of the state through Canada. The next section is foundational natural resource data information, subdivision 5. There are several appropriations here to do gathering data sets that are critical to informing effective management, restoration, planning. One is updating the statewide land use cover maps. And they have not been updated since 2000. And the land cover land use maps are a foundational data set used in ladder and water conservation efforts, used by local county and state agencies to guide and prioritize their efforts. Some other projects in that section that are very specific to what this council does, there's some restoring and forest inventory data to some historical data sets, forest inventory being one of them, kind of linking more recent data to improve our understanding of long-term forest trends. Another project is looking at, there's a large spectrum of records throughout the state on phenology, which is timing of seasonal biological events, just tree budding and flowering. By compiling all this information in a single place, you then have an ability to assess how things change and adapt to change and react to change over time. And we are also, the trust fund will also be investing in completing the Minnesota Green Bird Atlas, which is a comprehensive survey throughout every township in the state on the density and concentration diversity of all the bird species in the state. And this is an important guide and tool for planning habitat protection, restoration, management, and so forth. There is a strong component in this year's bill on pollinators, and it shows up in several places in the bill. One of them is in this section. There will be a wild bee pollinator survey in the prairie grassland area. As you probably know, pollinators play a huge role both in ecology of the natural ecosystems and as well as agriculture. There's about $15 billion a year in the U.S. relies on pollination. Wild bees are part of that. And they're going to find out where they are in the state, how the diversity of the pollinators in each part of the state. And this one is focusing on prairie and grasslands. Long term, though, the effort will be expanded to look at forests and forest transition to the state. There's another project looking relating to pollinators is looking at some imperiled butterfly species that have recently been proposed for listing on the Endangered Species Act. And this, Minnesota Zoo is partnering with the DNR to do some breeding and also some surveying to find out where these populations of these butterflies still exist. And do play a, and also play an important role in pollination. It's also a continuation of some research analysis pertaining to the declining moose populations in northeast Minnesota. The trust fund has made three investments so far in research on moose populations. This is two additional investments. None of these are really acting alone. They're separate appropriations, but all these efforts are coordinated with one another, using each other's data. They're just looking at very specific components of what might be caused behind this. So one of them is looking at kind of the habitat quality and landscape change and how that might be impacting moose populations. Another one is looking at how air temperature affects moose behavior and habitat use, reproductive success, survival. Continuing on to subdivision 6, which is methods to protect, restore, enhance land, water, and habitat. $3.7 million and 11 appropriations.
Mike?
Yes.
You're going to run out of time. You can speed it up just a little.
Sure.
That would be great. Maybe summarize for us to go through each one.
So we have additional ones looking at pollinators here, the effects of pesticides on them. There's collection research analysis for promoting long-term prairie sustainability. They're going to collect the germplasm and store it long term to create long term prairie sustainability. Some restoration work in northeast Minnesota on white cedar. Some restoration work in the metro area on prairie forest and savanna. Subdivision 7, land acquisition for habitat and recreation, $7 million for six appropriations. The ones that are probably most relevant to your work is one that's focused on the scientific and natural area system. And there's another, as you well aware from your last 2 years, some of the prime habitat in the metropolitan areas is in the park system. And so this is permanently protecting some more of that habitat in the park system. Subdivision 8 is air quality, climate change, renewable energy. It's a lot of research analysis relating to renewable energy production technologies and analysis of agricultural systems and technology to improve farming and other systems to be more efficient. The last one is environmental education, which is $3.7 million. There's a large focus this year on providing experiential outdoor experiences and trying to increase underrepresented populations in outdoor experiences, trying to find out how efforts to try and get underrepresented populations involved in natural resource professions in the future, as well as a lot of environmental education efforts and community and school treatment pollinators, wolves, ranchers, etc. So that is the bill in summary. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thanks for speeding that up there. Any questions that anyone has? I think this is helpful for us to understand what it is that you're doing and any impacts it might have. There are obviously some research projects that you're recommending funding for, that the results of which could have influence on some of the things we might see as proposals in the future.
I think along that line, I'd just like to point out as an example, 6E, which is by the Nature Conservancy. It's a watershed plan. The question is, will they come to us to implement it? We want them to, we encourage them to do it, that sort of thing. So we need to, as a council, just figure out how this all fits together and be cognizant of what they're doing and the intellectual side of this restoration enhancement. And
great. Thanks very much.
Sure.
Next on our agenda is an update on the forecast. Michelle Mitchell from Minnesota Management and Budget. Tell us mostly good news.
You have a staple document in your packet that has three numerical analyses. The first one being the Outdoor Heritage Fund based on no sales tax changes.
So, Mr. Chair, Council members, my name is Michelle Mitchell with the Outdoor Budget. I'm presenting today again about the changes from the November forecast, as well as updating you on what the impacts will be to the Outdoor Heritage Fund if business-to-business sales taxes are repealed. So as Mr. Becker mentioned, the stapled packet will start with the front page. And this, again, is based on no sales tax changes. So this is simply comparing the November forecast to the February forecast. So I'll draw your attention to basically the second line down, sales tax receipts. There is an estimated higher sales tax receipts in the February forecast, roughly $1.2 million in FY14, fiscal year 14, and about $2.1 million in fiscal year 15. So if this comes to pass, the Outdoor Heritage Fund would have about an 8.2% reserve on the bottom line. And this figure does include the Shell Rock River project that the council has endorsed.
The additional.
Now moving on to the second and third pages of your packet, I just want to point out some key things before I dive into these summaries, and it's really about, we really don't know what the enacted sales tax package will be. These one-page summaries are just summarizing what has already been proposed. And each of these tax packages are repealing those business taxes, and the difference is really in the effective dates. And each of these summaries also includes the additional $700,000 for Shell Rock. So I will draw your attention first to the governor's recommended sales tax changes. How this summary is laid out is that the top section is showing current law, the current enacted budget, as well as the Outdoor Heritage Bill as amended. The second highlighted line is the impact of the repeal. So under the governor's proposal, there would be about a $600,000 decline in fiscal year 14 and about 4.3 in 15, leaving the overall reserve at 2.8%. Comparing that then to the next page showing the House tax package that has passed the House floor, the overall change to sales taxes would be a negative 1.7 in fiscal year 14 and about 4 million in fiscal year 15, making about a 1.9% reserve. Now, the key piece of this information is that since the council has been concerned with leaving a 5% reserve overall, the fund is able to weather these kinds of sales tax fluctuations without necessitating further reductions to the bill. And with that, I'll stand.
What you're really seeing is if there is a repeal next year, we're going to have a reduction in the total amount available to us, both because the receipts will go down and because to bring our reserve to 5%, we will have to actually allocate less to fill the hole that would be created by not changing the recommendations this year, but spending some of the reserve that we have created.
I think it's a little bit more immediate than that, Mr. Chair. The FY15 is what spending is going through the legislature today. Is that not correct? So that 1.9% is the conservative estimate of our cushion on the bill moving through today.
I didn't say that.
I thought you were talking about what we were going to allocate for next.
What I'm saying is that if we're left with 1.9%, the 16 recommendations that we would work on in the fall to get us back to 5% would have to reduce the overall amount that we're allocating, because we're in essence going to draw up on that in the 15 process.
Your fiscal intelligence is far beyond mine. I wasn't looking at that one.
Any questions? Thank you.
I don't know if I missed it, but did the 1.9, does that take into account the possible return of the $570,000 from that project? Or is the 1.9 assuming that will be spent?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, it does not.
It does not take into account that money that we know may come back to us, and that would be the equivalent of about a 0.5%.
Roughly.
Okay, thank you.
It also doesn't take into account anything else that might expire in July, end of June, that might come back to us as well. So there's a little bit of wiggle room. Members, the last thing on the agenda today, other than any public comment, is really to take a look at a revision to the scoring system as to how we would initially rank proposals that we review over the summer and late summer. This is in a draft form. This is really an opportunity for the council to weigh in on the strategy of moving to this kind of a process. We don't need to actually finalize it today. But we need to let the committee know that's working on it, that it's not a committee, but the group that's working on it. Is this the right track? Where would we want any modifications or corrections?
So with that, I'm going to turn this over to this group. There are two things in your packet, a mock-up of a scoring sheet, and then a three pieces of paper taken together. Description of the current call criteria and how that translates into the scoring sheet. So, Heather, you want to...
Mr. Chair, there was a group convened who offered up their services to help us to review the call for funding requests as well as the scoring and evaluation materials, and it was Scott Raw, Jane Kingston, and Sue Olson. So please feel free to chime in at any time to either elaborate or correct what I'm about to say. I think the overriding endeavor here was to make the evaluation scoring line up better with the application and the call for funding request. Overall, I think it did a fairly good job. I think we've had the information in front of the council in order to make good and deliberate decisions, but sometimes it was a hunt and peck kind of exercise, and each year we've modified the application just a wee bit and not necessarily the other components, so that it all hasn't kept a pace here. And so this is an effort to make it more linear, more logical, and easier to follow for all concerned, both the applicant as well as the reviewers. What the pieces before you attempt to do is to lay out what those criteria are and how they relate to elements within the online system. And while David said we don't need to finalize this evaluation piece today, we do need to be aware that any changes to the system would need to have to be made right away if we were to keep it our April 1st call for funding request release date. It does take a number of hours to program the system to make any additional changes. So if you see something that really just jumps out at you, you know, please do let us know at your earliest possible convenience. So if you take a look, if you can run along, run these two pieces side by side, and there are 12 criteria that are laid out on this 8.5 by 14 sheet. The points have been adjusted from a 0 to 10 scale to a 0 to 6 scale. Or sorry, it was a 1 to 10, and now it's a 0 to 6 scale. So the total maximum for any application now is 72 points. And they have been broken down accordingly, and I won't bother to run through that, but you can see across this sheet how those lay out. Zero being completely disagree, six being, you know, this proposal criteria is completely right on, in which you completely agree with it, and then three being that neutral point. So then on either side of three, then, will be the variations of agree or disagree with a particular element. You turn your attention to the multiple sheet that has the current call criteria, phrase on score sheet, response scale, and points possible. And then the last column, I think, is the really important piece here, because it tells you where within the proposal you can find the answers to the questions that are being posed. So, for example, the first criteria, does the proposal address the actions and targets of one or more of the ecological sections? We have rephrased these elements to be more question-like, so you can answer on a 0 to 6 scale. But then you can find in the last column the place within the online proposal system where you can find that answer. So the answer to this question then would be under the ecological planning region data that's found on the first page of the application. So as you walk through each of these criteria, then it should be fairly evident as to where you might find them. We, as I said earlier, we are aligning that call for funding request to be in the same order as the criteria, so you will no longer have to sort of go back and forth throughout that proposal to have your questions answered. With that, I will stand for any questions or any comments regarding this. And again, I'd really like to thank Sue and Jane and Scott for their work on this. It's been extremely helpful in helping us to think through this evolving process.
Bill? I'd like to thank Elizabeth as well. And I want to let everybody know that we're going to do maps
as well. And we'll have a statewide map that shows where the program is working and an instruction to attach a map that describes the project in more detail, the neighborhood it's in, those kinds of things. And with that, are there questions about where we're at with this?
So I have a Scott?
Well, no, you go first and I'll.
I had a question on criteria or number two. And my question is not whether or not it's a good question, but if you have an acquisition project, it's going to score a zero because it's not applicable. And if you're looking at total scoring in the end, doesn't that put an acquisition project at in a position that's not as advantageous as a restoration project? Shouldn't this be opened up somewhat to indicate permanence, either restoration or acquisition?
We have been true to the criteria as they were adopted. What we've discovered going through this is are there a number of things like that that have to be accommodated, and I'm not certain what we're going to do on what we can do on that one.
Mr. Chair, what I would recommend is that we add a clause in there to address potential acquisitions. Will they be permanently protected?
That was what I was thinking, and then everybody's sort of in a level playing field in terms of the need for permanence in these projects.
We all ended up on exactly the same question. You know, and I thought and I was actually involved in that, but if it says, is it on permanent, is it on, or will it be on permanently protected land? That would, because then when you do an acquisition, then there's restoration that's involved with that, and that would then be on land that will be permanently protected. So if you change that wording to, is it on or will it be on lands that are permanently protected, that should then take acquisitions that have, you know, activity, whether that be burning prairie after it's a homeowner or planting grass in where crap is at now. That should put an acquisition on level playing field with that.
But if it's a straight acquisition, but it's you don't want to disadvantage a straight grade habitat acquisition project, I guess is my point. And so if staff can work to make sure that we level the playing field for acquisition and restoration enhancement, I think that would be fair.
And I think another element of that question in the past has been to avoid the redundant protection of land if it's already under some sort of protection as well.
So we will have to adjust the criteria as it appears in the call and on the score sheet.
Is there any objection to doing that? Okay. Other questions? I had one on number four, which if you look at the phrase on the score sheet, the proposal indicates leverage non-state funds or in-kind funds. If we're, I guess I don't want to disadvantage a project that goes to other state funds for leverage when we're trying to leverage the dollars coming out of the legacy amendment. So if it were clean water funds out of the legacy amendment that matched it one for one, is that a bad thing for an investment on our part? Or if it came out of the environmental trust fund, or if it came out of bonding, or who knows where else, if it leverages these funds, I would argue it's a good thing, and we shouldn't disadvantage projects that do have leverage regardless of where the funds actually come from. But I'm wondering if the committee had talked about that and there's a reason why you have this specific sort of carve-out for state funds.
Mr. Chair, my experience, and I'd ask Greg and Janelle too, is that usually when we're talking about matching funds, we're talking about bringing in additional funds to the state. So you're viewing it from the state fiscal viewpoint.
that viewpoint is from the state fiscal viewpoint. I think your viewpoint is from the habitat viewpoint.
Yeah, it's from these specific funds. Are we getting a bang for the buck from someplace? Danny, did you?
Well, Mr. Chair, I support the idea that we would eliminate non-state myself, because I remember specifically we had a buffering proposal that partnered with, I believe, was clean water money, and I scored that high because I thought it was good. We were partnering together with some other state money, so it almost would be like we wouldn't look at that positively. I think that's also a positive thing, that we should not exclude that. I think it would be better, and again, I would ask if the group had some discussion along that line.
Well, one of the things that I calculated in that is that we have projects that mandate that they be cost shared with other funds. Our buffer program, I mean, if you remember, was can only be used on projects that have a clean water buffer attached to them. That mandates cost share and mandates that they get points for that, you know, when in essence they don't really have any choice other than to do that if they want this money. You know, when I looked at leverage, I was looking at what I would consider non-traditional sources of leverage. I mean, obviously the Environmental Trust Fund's been around forever. I mean, the Clean Water Fund not as long. But when I'm trying to value leverage, I mean, one tax dollar added on to another tax dollar doesn't appear to me to be terribly unique leverage. It's when organizations and entities go out and raise their own leverage. You know, to me, that's a dollar that has more value as leverage than just tying up or mandating that we tie up with some other state sales tax dollar fund. So I think there's some value, and maybe you have two categories or two scoring criteria for leverage as to where it came from, because non-traditional sources of leverage, when you have an organization that throws in 10% of their own money, that to me has more value than, because that adds the total number of dollars to the project. If you just go take 10% leverage from another state fund, it doesn't add to the total. Non-traditional sources of leverage add to the total, and that's why I think they should have a higher value.
Unless you're taking from money that wouldn't have gone to Habitat from another state source. You know, if you use the Environmental Trust Fund, they could put that money in research, or they could put it in matching programs we're doing for Habitat. Is that good leverage, or don't we care about it? Kind of guy. And I don't know. Elizabeth?
Okay. I think probably I come from a viewpoint that when you reach outside the state, you get to a personal level. When you get leverage from local organizations, from community organizations, you're getting engagement at the same time. You're getting future benefit that grows and makes that area of the state perhaps more conservation-minded. And so there's a multiple effect. It probably relates to that last term in there, local outreach, education, and community engagement may also be considered advantageous. Well, generally, when you have to put your money there, you get that. So I think that has a multiplier effect and makes it far more effective, that leverage, than what just going to another state fund. Now, as far as the critters are concerned that are out there, they don't care where the money comes from. But as far as the public involvement in building local capacity, I think that this other than state match has benefits. So I have a tendency to score that higher.
So Bill just wrote down, ask a duck. I guess, Scott, what do you want to do with federal match? It's tax dollars. Is that a good, you know, if we get federal match on easements, is that something that we want to score higher than state match of the same easement from bonding or something else? I mean, that the question is, to me, is are we
are we leveraging our dollars to get more habitat protected? So I only bring it up if nobody cares about it but me, that's fine.
I have a comment, which is convenient.
Please.
We did talk about leverage a lot, and we talked about all the things we're talking about now. Leverage is leverage, and a lot of people think of different types of leverage as being good or bad, and you've just heard some examples of what those are. My opinion is leverage, you know, we talked about waiting even, although we didn't get into the nitty-gritty of waiting, and I don't mean to get off on a tangent, but to me, leverage is not as critical a criteria as some of these other comparators, the other 11, for all the reasons that we're talking about. I think that it's an interesting concept, but it doesn't define the total impact on the land and the value of the project in and of itself and the likelihood of success. So that being said, you know, me saying that leverage isn't as important in my mind, I think the wording, the phrasing in the second column, phrase on score sheet, does not exclude state dollars. It says the proposal identifies leverage, non-state funds, and or in-kind contributions. It's very inclusive. So I think anybody who's doing the evaluations can make it whatever they can substantiate and have some kind of a logical basis for assigning the numbers, and that's the job of each of us.
Okay. Well, I would support taking out non-state.
So, do you want to make a motion to that?
Yes, I would.
All right. Any discussion? Sandy, will you call the roll?
So the motion is to remove non-state.
Yes would be to remove, no would be to keep it as it is.
Jim Cox.
Yes.
Jane Kingston.
No.
Representative McNamara.
Yes.
Sue Olson. Scott Rall.
No.
Can I lose you?
Yes.
Oh,
Sue?
No.
Elizabeth Wilkins.
No.
Chair Hartwell.
Yes.
Lee Ford fails.
Fails, all right. We'll leave it in. Any other questions?
I didn't vote.
Did you get five?
Bob.
Yes.
So now we're four tied.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen did tell me it was room in 400, and if those were all call vote to go get them. Is it all right? Somebody should probably go get them. He specifically asked that he's in the building.
Okay. So we'll delay the vote. I don't know procedurally what the thing is, but we'll just delay this vote until Representative Hansen gets here.
Can you just explain?
Other comments on this?
Just to, Mr. Chair, the question on 7A, I guess, is trying to understand the term historic value.
We talked about that at length, and I can tell you that I know, for example, that Heron Lake in southwest Minnesota has historic value to game fish and wildlife. It has been a duck hunting mecca for not so much anymore, but was. And I asked the same question. I said, how does anybody that's not from southwest Minnesota know that Heron Lake has historic value? I mean, if you were going to pull up some northern Minnesota spot that, you know, that we shot the biggest deer out of, or the biggest elk out of the last 40 years. I wouldn't know that. I have a really hard time determining that, but it's in the language. There's some language that we pulled those words from it, which got put there. Was that right? The historic value? We got that from somewhere else.
To that effect?
Right.
Jane?
Mm-hmm.
Chair, Bill, I'm just looking at the first column. It looks like you've had it in your proposal before.
That's correct.
I think where we created it. I'm not sure.
I think we created it. It's not in statute or anything else. So we have the right to uncreate it if we wish.
I'm just trying to understand that.
It is a confusing term because, you know, there's no place in the state that doesn't have historic wildlife value if you go back far enough.
May I chime in on that, too?
Sure.
During our discussions, I suggested that we strike that. There isn't any habitat that isn't arguably of value historically to fish and wildlife. Just ask the fish or the wildlife, and they'll tell you they value it. So I think it's the meaningless criteria.
Jim?
Well, I think what we're trying to get is that if Nick, the term is major, but the landscapes. I think Scott's Heron Lake, Swan Lake, if you're going to shallow lakes. I mean, there's just certain. I think we didn't want to start trying to develop wetlands in the middle of Renville County. We wanted to do this work where historically we've had these landscapes and these populations. I think was the thing.
Thank you.
Well, what is historic?
Long time.
Yeah, I know, so it doesn't mean anything to me. It's not definitive.
20 years.
It's not definitive at all.
So, Jane, are you making a motion?
Yeah, I made the motion in our committee, and this is what came out of our committee.
Okay, hang on. You can't make a motion because we have one on the floor that we're trying to get a vote on.
I didn't get that. What was that?
Just hang on a second.
Please hold.
Please hold.
So, Ms. Smith is explaining to Mr. Hansen what the situation is for the record.
How would you like to vote?
Well, let me just make sure I understand this so I'm clear that I'm fully informed where I'm voting. You're on a provision, so I understand there's a tie. So
there's a tie.
So you're on the provision in the call relating to whether to strike non-state funds, and then that would allow for, if there were state funds, say bonding dollars, that that could match against a project. So you would be able to.
And the two arguments for that are, the language doesn't require the leverage to be specifically state or non-state. It's foggy, so each person can determine what that provision would make and be consistent in their own scoring. That's one side, and the other side is striking non-state makes it clear that other resources from other sources within the state would count as leverage as you're scoring. Is that fair in terms of the two sides?
I would support striking non-state.
Okay. Yes, so that's a yes vote, Sandy. I think that's 5-4, correct? Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Thank you, Rick. Now you want to know who was on which side.
You're in trouble now.
You're in trouble with four of us. We're not going to tell you which four.
And I'm chairing the meeting upstairs, so I'm going to have to run back up there.
Okay.
If you need me again,
send we'll come get you. Thank you. We appreciate you.
Jane's going to make a motion.
He's got to go chair the meeting. If we have a tie, we'll bring him back down.
Oh.
Jane, are you wanting to make a motion or not?
Well, you know, I went along with the committee because this is language that's been in there since the onset. I would argue with Jim's position that Heron Lake is more important than wetlands or a pothole in the middle of Renville County. I'd argue that Renville County needs it more than anything, but or anywhere. But I don't feel that strongly about it. I'm kind of on the. I'd like to hear what the council wants to do, because I could live with it easily without being there, but I don't know if the going to cause heartburn to other people.
Bob, do you have a desire to monkey with it?
Not for a point and a half.
All right. Anyone else want to recommend a change? Okay. Anything else?
Item number eight, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Okay, Bob, thank you.
I'm not sure that I understand. That I would be able to determine whether their budget is appropriate or not.
Scott?
Well, what we did there, Bob, is if you take a look at restoration and you have all your projects laid out there and you can look at all the budgets for all of those, and if one of those is four times higher than the rest of them, or one of them is four times lower than the rest of them, then you can look at that and say, you know, is that budget appropriate based on all the scopes of work that you see? Is that budget appropriate to get the job done? And if it's four times too high, then that would lead you to believe maybe that it's not appropriate. If it's way below to the point where you saw it, if no one else can get it done for that, you certainly can't get it done for that, then that also might take them out of range. But normally that isn't appropriate would be, is it appropriate when compared to all of the other projects that you get to see of like kind?
Mr. Chair, I would also add that as part of the deliberation too, there are three elements that you really need to pay attention to in evaluating proposals. One is the scope of work, the second is the budget, and the third is the outcome. And so as you compare those three elements, they should all be in alignment. So it's not just amongst proposals, but it's also within the proposal itself. We also have the benefit, too, I would add, of having recommended phased programs, and so being able to go back and look at previous requests and appropriations and what their outcomes would be really helpful as you assess the budget.
Okay. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Great. Any other questions or comments? So maybe I misspoke and we're not formally approving this, or do we need to do that, Bill?
Mr. Chair, I think, as I said earlier, that this is a gatekeeping exercise and staff consider the gate open unless you close it. So if you want us to do something other than what you've described in motions today, we'll take this and translate it into the score sheet that you see and re-code the application system so that it reflects the information that we're providing in that last column for you.
So we didn't make a motion on two, but there was a sense that that would get fixed. Do we need to make a motion to that, or do you want to just ask for a motion to approve what we've done, including addressing and fixing number two so it's fair to both restorations and acquisitions?
I'm very comfortable with the comprehensive motion that goes quickly.
Would someone be willing to make a motion to have staff address number two and then incorporate the other changes that we voted on and have this serve as our evaluation criteria, which is part of the call that will go out April 1st.
I would do that.
Is there any discussion?
Just a point of order. Would we still be able to do it on paper and submit it to staff to enter? Or do we have to do it online?
We take paper.
We'll take paper.
I'm full paper makers like paper.
We would not want to get in the way of old paper makers. Will you call the roll, Sandy?
Jean Kingston.
Yes.
Representative McNamara.
Yes.
Sue Olson.
Yes.
Scott Roth.
Yes.
Elizabeth Wilkins.
Yes.
Bob Anderson.
No.
Jim Cox.
Yes.
Chair Herbel.
Yes. Motion passes.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
One comment on this process. If you ever get in a committee with Ms. Wilkins, Jane, and Sue, you can guarantee that you will spend lots of time making sure punctuation is absolutely correct.
Thanks for the warning. This is an opportunity for the public to address the council. I don't know if anybody wants to address. Is there anyone out there that would like to address the council? If not, we're adjourned. Thank you all.